So we start today with Cedric Bow. Hey, Peter. That's the parsha of the week. All right, Cedric Bow is the Cedric which describes the final Makos and then the actual exodus from Egypt. The final Makos, Arba, Choshech, and Makas Becharos. Now, I mentioned briefly last week, and it just pays to reiterate, Rav Aviner writes that the purpose of a Makos is not just to punish the Egyptians. And in fact, it's not only what we think, that it was also just a means to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. The way the Torah phrases it, Leman Teda, Kiyani Hashem Mekar of Haaretz, that the Egyptians should know that there's a God on earth, but what is the vehicle by which they know they'll know that God is on earth? Well, it can't just be the Makos, because the Egyptian magicians were able to duplicate at least some of them. So they might think that just that Moshe's magic is better than their magic, or even that Moshe's God is more powerful than their God, but it wouldn't necessarily singularly teach them of the existence of God. It had to be some enduring legacy. And what is that legacy? Kol Yisrael. It's not just the fact that there are Makos in Egypt, because others could do that too. It's the fact that the Makos emphasized the Egyptians that there's a special class of people in the world, Kol Yisrael. And so nature, which is a constant in everyone's life, you know, it's snowing on us today, we're learning here, and it's snowing on people across the street who are not learning Torah altogether. So it snows on everyone when it snows, and it rains on everyone when it rains. Not so the Makos. The Makos, you had deviations of nature that in fact were not consistently applied. Because wherever the Jews were, they did not suffer from it. So if the water turned to dam, it didn't happen to Jews. Their water was water. If the Egyptians were afflicted with frogs, it didn't happen to the Jews. And so on through the Makos, we'll see today, the Maka of Choshech especially. And most dramatically, Makas Becharos. When the firstborn of the Egyptians were killed, the night of Pesach, the night of our Seder, and that precipitated the hasty departure, literally pushed out by Paro. So then it became clear that word that's used several times, v'ifli, v'niflinu, will be separated, will be divided, will be distinguished from the others. And so Kol Yisrael was distinguished from the other nations, certainly from Egypt, and that distinction, that separation, exists to this day. They don't let us forget it, but it exists to this day, and it got its start here. Why? Because that's the enduring reminder to the nations of the world of God's existence. So just like we have a reminder through, everyone has a reminder really through nature, that God is the creator and the source of all nature, but we have a special reminder of God as Habochar Bami Srobiavo, that he chose us, gave us the Torah, Mitzos, the special providence over our fate. All that is true, but it comes out that we have two modes of relationship to God, through nature and through a special hashgacha, whereas the nations of the world have only one, through nature. It's in fact not so. They have a second one also. What's their second mode of relationship to God? Through Kol Yisrael. Through recognizing that God has a special relationship with the Jewish people. Now, granted, they don't always appreciate it, but in time they will. When I say in time, of course, I'm referring to Yimas HaMashiach. Until then, only individuals will, but not the nations of the world en masse.
Well, during Yimas HaMashiach, there will be Goyim?
Absolutely. Absolutely there'll be. See, we don't maintain that Yimas HaMashiach already converts to Judaism. You can't have enough shuls to hold everybody. Too much talking anyway. Now, imagine if we had another 6 billion people to watch over. So in the Mosa Mashiach, all that will happen, Kimalo Haaretz Deyos Hashem, Kamayim Layam Chasim, that the world is filled with knowledge of God, as the seas cover the earth now. The world is filled with knowledge of God. Bayam Hu Yashem Echad Hashma Echad. God's name is one. It means that all nations are called upon to acknowledge God.
So why wouldn't they convert?
They could if they want, but it's not necessary. All they have
I'm
to
saying
do is
if there's a mass knowledge.
Because all they're obligated to do is follow the seven mitzvahs of Noach. They have to follow the Noahide laws, and then they're very worthy, holy, decent, moral people, God-fearing people. Non-Jews not asked to convert. You know, we don't say it's a deficiency in them that they're not Jewish. On the contrary, that's the way they were created. Yeah, according to some, they have an advantage, really. They have an advantage. It's easier for them, in a sense, to attain Olam HaBa than it is for us. We have many more pitfalls. We have Taryag Mitzvahs. They just have seven. So granted, the privileges are greater, too. God wanted to confer merit upon us. So we have a greater ability to attain greater heights in Olam HaBa. That much is true. But in a sense, they have easier lives if only they lived it properly. They have the seven Noahide laws, which are not that cumbersome. Not that cumbersome. It just it forces them to adhere to a basic code of morality, which if they didn't, the world would be transformed. You're not really asking that much. Don't murder, don't steal, don't be idolatrous, don't be immoral, chop off a limb from a living animal and eat it, don't blaspheme, establish a legal system so you'll be civilized. That's all we're asking them to do.
They have
Noahide
now,
don't they? Yeah, sure. It's a movement in the tens of thousands today that's growing, but growing slowly. It's good that it exists. Very good that it exists. Mainly people have rejected Christianity and not converted to Judaism. What's that?
How come they don't want to convert? They just feel...
I happened to ask this question to David Davis, who was one of the founders of the Noahide movement in America. It wasn't me, it was someone else asked him. Give a shiur in the yeshiva. And he said to us, because the Torah doesn't say he has to. God created two types of individuals, Jews and Gentiles. He's a Gentile. There's no aspiration to be a Jew. There's no need to be a Jew. He can relate to God through his mode. So this is B'nai Noach. And in fact, he's the classic case, because he recognizes B'nai Noach through the Torah, or the mitzvah B'nai Noach through the Torah. And he recognizes the greatness and special character of the Jewish people. So that's the highest level they can attain, and it's a very high level. How about Jews should reach that level in only our mitzvahs? To understand that they all come from God, they have to accept it. Alright? If you want to be depressed, this goes back now, I guess, 10, 12 years when I met him. He asked, we had a shiur, but I guess 50, 60 people there in yeshiva. And he asked, he said, now that you asked me a question, let me ask you a question. How come you don't live in Israel? He said he's read through the Bible dozens of times, and clearly the Jews have to live in Israel. So how is it possible that you're sitting here learning Torah, not in Israel? Dead silence in the room. Complete silence. It's a good question. Good question. Anyway, that was the purpose of the Machlokes, the ultimate purpose, to single out the Jewish people so that they would be known as the Am Hashem. And that's what happened. Of course, the relationship was concretized 7 weeks after Yetzias Mitzrayim at Maimon Har Sinai, and then we go out into the world with all the glories and all the ignominies of going out into the world. Let's understand the last two Makos. So Makos Bechoros, of course, was the most challenging to all of Egypt, because what it basically said to them is that their lives are not theirs anymore. That this God, this force that in Shmos Paro did not know, is so powerful that they're all going to die, and he is just a representative sample. Whereas the other Makos targeted specific aspects of their lives, whether it was the atmosphere, or their person, or the ground, sea, earth, etc., This targeted their very lives. And when they saw that was happening, every Bechor died. Every Bechor died. We Bechor Paro, Hayashev Al Kisel, Paro's Bechor died. To the Bechor of Avodim, to the Bechor of prisoners, every Bechor died. Except, of course, for the Bechor Yisrael. And then they realized everything else was just, you know, a slap, a knock in the head. It was discomforting. It was inconvenient. It was annoying. It was designed to get their attention, but it didn't kill them. And now once it started to kill them, they said, that's it. We have no chance. We mention this, of course, every Shabbos morning in Tehillim in a very interesting pasuk. L'makei Mitzrayim b'vchoreihem ki le'olam chasdo. It's in Halal Gadol. L'makei Mitzrayim b'vchoreihem, to the one who smote the Egyptians through their firstborn, ki le'olam chasdo, his kindness endures forever. So what's the pshat? If you're medayik in the words, Rashi there says, quoting the Medrash, L'makei Mitzrayim b'vchoreihem, that literally means he smote the Egyptians through the firstborn, as if the firstborn were the instrument to kill the Egyptians. And in fact, the Medrash says it did happen, that when the notification about Makas Bechoros came out, and Paro still refused to send the Jews out, the Bechorim of Egypt rebelled. And they said, we don't want to die, and they provoked a civil war. And thousands of Egyptians were killed in this civil war, and of course it didn't have any resolution. By the time it finished, the night of Tesvav came, and they died. So that's literally L'makei Mitzrayim b'vchoreihem, that the Egyptians were killed through the firstborn who killed them. Of course, the Medrash is not the simple pshat. The simple pshat is that God smote the Egyptians with the most powerful blow, which was Makas Bechoros. And that gives rise to the question, what then does it mean, ki le'olam chasdo? How is that an expression of God's kindness, that God smote the Egyptians? We could see it as din. I mean, kindness towards Klal Yisrael, that's for sure. But we could see it as din. It's din. It's an expression of God's attribute of justice.
I didn't tell everybody.
Oh, we'll see. 1 second. I guess so. But and then if you kill everyone, then there's no lesson to be learned from it, because then there's no one to look at God. Well, they're outside. It's the Egyptians really who become the Edom. Maybe you're correct in a historical sense. Maybe correct entirely too. We have to look into that. But where's the chesed? And we're able to distinguish between the midas chesed, midas rachamim, and the midas adin, the attribute of mercy or kindness, and the attribute of justice. So the makos seem to be, on the surface, just. Justice. Not chesed, not kindness. Alright, so where is the kindness there? That we have to understand. For that, we'll look to the mako of Choshech. Choshech is a very interesting mako because it's different in kind from all the other makos. Look at Perek Yud, Pasuk Chafal. See, all the other makos touch their physical selves, or target their physical selves, on the one hand, and on the other hand, not everyone was affected by it. You know, it was limited populations that were affected by each. But Choshech affected everybody. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Niteh Yodcho al Hashamayim, V'Choshech al Eretz Mitzrayim. God said to Moshe, stretch forth your hand to the skies, and there will be darkness on the land of Egypt, v'yomesh choshech, and the darkness will become even darker. Rashi says, v'yachshich aleihem choshech yoser michoshko shalaylo. The darkness will be more dark than the darkness of night. V'choshech shal, and that's during the day. V'choshech shalaylo yamish v'yachshich od. And the darkness of night will be even darker than that darkness. So they had utter darkness and utterly extreme darkness.
Neither is agreed. Once it's dark, can't get dark.
You would think so. That's why the Pasuk comes to say no.
Well, it's darker than black.
There you go. But you're correct. It would seem once it says choshech, so v'yomesh choshech. All right, we're a little to us a little ambiguous, maybe a little hard to understand, because we look at darkness as night. And our nights are not completely dark. There's always some light at night. I don't just mean the artificial light, but even there's light from heaven. What's that?
Stars, moon.
Right, there is some light. So we're not talking about the darkness of light, of night. We're talking about some different type of darkness. And again, our darkness is just the absence of light. Sun is set, but there is the luminaries that reflect the light of the sun that provide us some light. Really not that much light. Again, we're misled because we have all the artificial lighting, the electric lighting. But if you're in a place where there's no lighting at all, it's dark. It's dark. You could recognize someone, you know, if they come up to you. That's, by the way, the shear for wearing tzitzis in the morning. You have to be able to distinguish between purple and like a bluish green. All right, or between a purplish color and a white. So that is a distance. Or another shear is that you could recognize your friend at four amos, so 7 feet away. So it means during the darkness of night, if there's no light at all, you could recognize someone 7 feet away. They come right up to you, you could recognize them. But at a distance of 7 feet, you can't. If you could, then that already means that the day is coming. So this is a different type of darkness than just absence of light. Well, what type is it? Torah continues. Vayek Moshe siyado al shamoyim. Moshe stretches forth his hand to the heavens. Vayichoshech afeilo b'chol eretz Mitzrayim shloshes yamim. And there is darkness, murky darkness, afeilo. Murky darkness on the land of Egypt, shlosh yasimim, for 3 days. In those 3 days, lo ra'u ish es achiv, lo kamu ish mitachtov, shlosh yasimim. Those 3 days, nobody saw his friend, his brother. No one was even able to stand up for 3 days.
Does it say for the other mafos how long they
are? Sometimes it does. Could be a day, could be a week. Ulechol b'nei Yisrael haya'or b'mashrasam. For the Jews, there was light. We actually know the 3 days also. What are the 3 days? It was Yud Aleph, Yud Beis, and Yud Gimel Nisan. Those are the 3 days of Choshech. So on Yud Nisan, they went, the Torah is a little out of order chronologically. What's that? Yud, Shabbos HaGadol. Shabbos HaGadol was, no, not necessarily. Because I think they went out on a Friday. Yeah, went out on Friday. So this is probably Sunday. Yud was a Sunday. There are different opinions when it was. But on the 10th, they were instructed regarding the Karban Pesach. That's the Yud Beis. They had to set aside this animal, the sheep. On the 11th, 12th, and 13th, there was darkness. And you dial it Erev Pesach. So that was all the preparations, the Shechem Pesach, the blood, etc. Okay. What does it mean they couldn't see? So it's dark, they couldn't see. They couldn't stand. Why couldn't they stand? So Rashi continues. That V'yomesh, so V'yomesh, Rashi says the root is like emesh, last night, meaning a time of darkness, of absence of light. But V'yomesh also is the root of another word in it. What's that word? Mamash, mamashut, substance, mamashus, a substance, something tangible. So Rashi says, "Umedrash agodo poser loshem mimashesh betzarayim," like a person feeling his way. Shaya kaful umechupol ve'ov, that the darkness was doubled, redoubled, and of thick, ad shehaya mamish, until it was palpable. It wasn't darkness, just an absence of light. It was a darkness like a thick fog. The Ibn Ezra says that darkness like the murkiness of the ocean. In other words, if you're down deep, it's very hard to move. Okay? It's a thick darkness. So, of course, it was miraculous. So we don't have that anymore. We don't have a darkness which is paralyzing. But that's what it was. That they could feel as if they're ensconced in a substance that prevented them even from moving. So, in fact, for those 3 days, they could not move. They had to sit in their places.
Even like a heavy fog.
But even the most pea soup fog in London is not going to prevent people from moving about. So this was more than that. I mean, this is we'll see. It was all the other miracles, except for Dom. Dom was really a transformation. Well, even Dom. I'm trying to think which of the miracles was the greatest deviation from nature. Because all of them really were just intensifications of the natural order. In other words, there are frogs. They had more frogs. You have lice, there's more lice. You have pestilence, more pestilence. You have hail, there's more hail. Well, the hail has also were fire and water together. But, and even Dom, so they're both liquids. And it was just an intensification of all the blood that's in the water. Oh, that's really miraculous. Well, the nature of the substance changed, liquid to liquid. That was the same, rather. But Choshech not. Choshech was nothing like that on Earth. Nothing like that on Earth. That a murky, thick darkness that prevents people from even moving about.
Some people didn't die?
Did not die.
Not
there are people who did die, though. All right, look at Rashi. We didn't hear that, though. The Loma Hevelem Choshech. So why did God bring this darkness upon Egypt? What kind of mock is it? So Rashi offers two opinions. Shehoyu b'Yisrael b'osador reshoyim. They were wicked people, wicked Jews in that generation too. V'lo hayiratzim latzeis. They didn't want to leave Egypt. Every Golus is like that. They don't. You know, every Golus. Who are we talking about? But every Golus, the people don't want to leave. Yeah. But thick darkness that prevents us from moving. All right. I guess you have a thick fog with you. You know, it slows you down. But even so, there's nothing that we have that is so intense that you can't walk in it. You can't even stand up.
And how was the fear or how was...
No, so they couldn't move. They could not move. Rashi says here, Choshech muchpal al zeh shel kamu ish mitachtov. Such a thick, redoubled darkness that had a palpability to it, a substance to it. So that we don't have. Anyway, so there is wicked Jews. They don't want to leave. Umesu b'shloshes me'afelos. They died during these three days of darkness. Kedei shlo yirup mitzriyim b'mapalosom. So the Egyptians should not see their downfall, because then they'll say, v'yomru avheimokim kamonu. There's really no God. Look, we're suffering. They're suffering too. So rather than distinguish the Jews from the Egyptians through the Makos, it'll lead them to say, no, we're all the same. It's some natural phenomenon we don't understand. So they were killed. The ode further, so that's a practical or almost a negative reason to get rid of the Jews who are sinners. But there's a utilitarian reason. I'm sorry, that's utilitarian. This is a benefit to the Jews. What happened was this gave the Jews 3 days to traipse through the homes of the Egyptians and see the golden and silver vessels that they had. And when they left, and we'll see the Torah says that we got reparations from Egypt. When they left, they would ask them, you know, we're taking your silver, taking your gold, and the Egyptians would say, we don't have that. We don't know what you're talking about. Omer lo, the Jew would say to him, I know exactly where it is, this is where you hid it, so I'm taking it. These 3 days of Choshech enabled the Jews to find out where the property, the valuables of the Egyptians were hidden. Yes. So from the darkness, so clearly they were able to see. It's exactly the same place. They were able to see. That's correct. There was some dimension of the Egyptians, some human dimension that was lost. So let's try to understand what that is. What is this punishment of Choshech? All right, which is really different in kind than all the others. Again, it has a sad aspect to it, that it was used to eliminate the Rasha'im, but it has also positive reparations that we discussed in past years. So Moshe is told by God they shouldn't have a taina that Avram was promised, Bachrechen Yetzu Berchush Gadol, now they'll leave with great wealth, and they're not leaving with anything. Or even worse, the taina that here we worked for all these this time as slaves, never paid for it. So now they got their, they would get their payment. But that wasn't the primary purpose of the Choshech. There has to be some other purpose to it. Now let's understand. So Medrash says, in the Medrash Rav and Shmos, Parshat Dalet, Shahado d'chsiv sholach Choshech v'yachshich. That God sent darkness by Achshich, it became even more dark, and they did not rebel against His words. All right, who's it talking about? The Malachim. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu LaMalachim HaMitzriim Ru'uyin Lulkos B'Choshech. It's appropriate for the Mitzriim to be punished with darkness. Miyad Hiskimu Kulon Kachas V'Lohim Ru. Right away, all the Malachim agreed. Yep, that's what they deserve. They deserve darkness. So what is it about this darkness they deserve? The Yomesh Choshech. How thick was that darkness? Rabbi Seinu Amru, Ove Kidinar Hoya. It was as thick as a coin. A coin. So a coin is pretty hard. You're stuck. Alright, had substance to it. Now, So Moshe stretched forth his hands to the heaven, and there was this murky darkness. Medrash asks a very interesting question. Where is this darkness from? In other words, Moshe stretched his hands to the heaven, so what does that mean? Where does the darkness come from? Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Nechemya. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mechoshech Shomolo. Rabbi Yehuda said it came from the Choshech above. The darkness above. Shenemar, Poskin Tehillim. Yoshes Choshech Sisro, that God sent forth the darkness from His concealment. Sviosav Sukaso, His surroundings are concealed in a sukkah, meaning He's able to hide Himself from His enemies. Where does the darkness come from, though? Sisro, we say, my God, it's Yoshev Sisro Yon. He's in the hidden place. That's Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Nechemya Omar Mechoshech Shel Gehinom. Rabbi Nechemya says, not the darkness of Shomala, but the darkness of Gehenna, of the netherworlds. All right? And the Medrash goes on to say that it's the darkness of Rishoyim. All right? L'fichach, Kadosh Baruch Hu mechas aleihem es hatahom, shu choshech. God covers the deep, which is completely dark. Shenemar v'choshech al p'nei sahom, second pasuk in the Torah. The darkness upon the face of the deep, Zegeinam, Tzgehenam. Hevi Omer, Choshech Shabala Mitzrim, but Mitoch Gehenam Hoya. From Yechami says, comes out that darkness came from Gehenam. Alright, so that's what we have to understand. What's the difference between Choshech Shomalo and Choshech Shel Gehenam? The darkness of above and the darkness from below. So what is that telling us? What do you say? What's the darkness from above? Or what's the darkness from below? Whenever the Torah uses the expression light and darkness, as a matter of fact, it's colloquial, because you have that in almost every language, every civilization. What does light refer to?
Knowledge.
Good. What does darkness refer to?
Ignorance.
That's correct. We say about someone, he's seen the light, all right? He's in the dark. That's what it means. So there are two types of situations a person finds himself in. He could be in the light about something. He could be in the dark about something. If someone's in the dark about something, especially about the important areas of life, it's the two types of darkness, really two types of ignorance that exists in the world. One type is choshech shomala. What's that? Intellectual ignorance. Ignorance about God. What Chazal is saying here in the Medrash is that the Egyptians were afflicted with two types of ignorance. One, the basic knowledge every person has to have is Yedias Hashem, knowledge that God exists, created the world, runs the world. That's the basic knowledge. The Egyptians were lacking in that knowledge, lacking like no other nation ever lacked, because they were the most impure of all the nations. Lo yadati es Hashem. Mi Hashem asher shema v'kolo. Lo yadati es Hashem. Pharaoh said, who's God? What God? I don't know of any God. That type of ignorance is the most profound ignorance a human being can suffer from. It means he's completely lost in the world. Rabbi Yehuda says, Moshe stretches forth his hand, Moshe did, in a symbolic sense, he stretched forth over Egypt, he physicalized a darkness that already existed in them, because they suffer from choshech shomala. They had no knowledge of God. Those who have no knowledge of God are already living in the utmost darkness. What Moshe did is dramatize to them the type of darkness in which they live, this intellectual darkness and absence of Yedias Hashem, which really makes the world into something which is murky and unlivable. That's only one type of darkness, though. That's the second type. But you see, they had knowledge of God. Yosef brought the knowledge of God. Oh, Jews, of course, absolutely. Well, they did. They knew from Avram. They knew such a thing existed. They didn't have a clear perception, but they rejected it. They're pagans. All right? All of Avram's converts had the fallen by the wayside already. Yeah, but you know, again, you have to keep in mind that they're not that far from the source. You know, they're not as distant as we are today. They are only, right now, we're talking just a little less than 800 years after the flood. Or it's not a long period of time. And Yosef himself had brought to Egypt. They knew who the Ivrim were. They knew how the Ivrim worship. They knew their different forces. They had some knowledge of it. And yet, by the time, what's that?
They didn't have a history channel.
They did not have a history channel, it's true.
Well, meaning history was not...
How do you know? You're talking, they had over almost 2.5 millennia, all right? The flood. You don't think Mishra Self was on biography? It was a special, it was probably 9-10 hours covered his whole life. 969 years, a long life. Sure, they could have known, because they were pagan, they rejected it. Yeah, Yosef certainly, Elohim Yeresh Lamparo, Yosef brought them an awareness of God too. But they rejected it. But Moshe's telling them, Moshe's demonstrating to them, this is the greatest darkness, you're already in darkness. The darkness that now becomes tangible is only a reflection of your inner darkness. Alright? That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. At the Mehechan Haya Choshech, Choshech Shomalo. It was just Yoshech Choshech Shisro, from God's concealment to the Rishon comes the greatest darkness. And the truth is, in the world, God's presence is not always visible, not always easy to see. The Shmila Alam, we read 2 weeks ago in Shmos, so God says, the Shmila Alam. In this world, God's name is hidden. You have to pierce the veils of nature in order to see, for most people to see God. So we have, through the Masorah, a little easier for us. But for the nations of the world, they have to pierce the veils of nature in order to perceive God. And yet they have the obligation to do that. And they have the ability to do that, because they're Tzelem Elokim too. They're created in the image of God, and they have functioning minds. They should be able to do that, if that was their choice. And yet we see that the Egyptians plunge themselves into darkness. And that's what this darkness is reflective of. They had 8 makos before from which they could have learned, because each time Moshe was prefacing it by saying, this is coming from God. All right? and still they did not. So it's one thing for Paro to say, Mi Hashem Asher Shema Bekololi Adati Es Hashem, before the Makos come, in Shmos. Once the Makos start coming, then he can't say that anymore. As a matter of fact, even in Vo'ero, you see, it said, Hayireim is Dvar Hashem Avdei Paro, amongst Paro's servants. Some started to fear God, so it wasn't universal anymore. They had made inroads, but not with the majority, not with the elite, and certainly not with Paro. That's one type of Choshech. It's an intellectual darkness that comes out of the lack of recognition of God. No Yedias Hashem. There's another type of darkness also. That's Choshech Shel Gehenna. What's that? What's the darkness of Gehenna? That's a moral darkness. It means theoretically, on some level, it's possible for a person to have no knowledge of God and yet still be able to treat another human being with dignity, even out of selfish utilitarian motives. He could say, I'm a creature, you're a creature. All right, or I'm a person, you're a person. The mice is very difficult, almost impossible in a godless society that you respect for human beings. Almost impossible. I say almost because I guess theoretically it's possible. What makes it almost impossible is history. The fact is, every godless society has been a brutal, tyrannical dictatorship. So you see that with an absence of a recognition of God as the guarantor of human rights, there really is no possibility for rulers to treat their people with dignity. Yet, you see, there's a moral darkness as well. People should be able, like take the Greek philosophers, for example, people should be able to ascertain the correct way to live, a way of life which is balanced, which is noble, which is ethical, which the Greek philosophers posited. Granted, they did not have a system by which they could transmit it to other generations. But theoretically, it's possible. It's bad enough that they're dwelling in the Choshech Shel Ma'alo, that they're afflicted by the Choshech Shel Ma'alo. They're afflicted by the Choshech Shel Gehenna as well. Alright? A complete absence of recognition of the value of human life. What was Egypt? It was the ultimate hierarchical society. You had several elites, a handful of elites, and everyone, like I mentioned on Shabbos, everyone else is just a sus, just a horse, just an ox, just a slave. There was, you know, millions and millions of people serving, you know, 5 or 10 people with one at the top. Top is shaped like, I guess, the hierarchy is shaped like a pyramid, literally. That's the pyramid. You have one point at the top, that's Paro. Everyone else is just a servant of Paro leading to the top. The pyramid is not just a building. It's a metaphor for their societal structure. So you have Choshech Shel Ma'alo and Choshech Shel Gehenna. So the Choshech Shel Gehenna is the inability of human beings to treat each other properly, to live together. And that's what Egypt became. What happens when you live in complete darkness? So Reb Nechemya says, that's Rishon. The Choshech Al Penei Sahom. The darkness is the darkness that is upon the face of the deep. What does it mean? What's Choshech Al Penei Sahom? What's the beginning of the pasuk? Baretz Hayisah, Sohu Vavohu, V'Choshech Al Penei Sahom. Reb Nechemya is describing Egyptian society as almost a primeval state of primordial chaos, the world before it was created, or really after it was created, before it took the form that it's in now. Just chaos. No human dimension to it. Nothing to justify its existence. It was a society really that was not only at war with itself, but inherently corrupt and undeserving of continued existence. Vayek Moshe Yado Al Hashamayim VaYichoshech Afelu B'Chol Eretz Mitzrayim Shloshes Yomim. These 3 days of darkness were really days in which the Egyptians were stripped of their humanity. You see, someone is in the dark is an essential aspect of his humanity is taken away. So we look in terms of ignorance. Someone's ignorant, he's not even a fully developed human being, because there's a substantial component which is not there. The Egyptians were made to dwell on this fact for 3 days, that they're not even people anymore. They're not even people. What are people? Lo ra'u ish esachiv. You can't see someone else. There's no society anymore. You don't relate to another human being. You can't see anyone. You're all alone. So, all right, you could live. You'll be an island. No. V'lo kol ish mitachtav. They can't even live themselves. So when they lost the ability to relate to one another, they lost the dimension of humanity which enables them even to live as people. All right? So this was the greatest clap that they could see to wake them up as a society, that they all deserve death. They have forfeited their existence. Right? So Naomi said very well before, L'makim mitzrayim bivchoreihem ki l'olam chasdar. What's the chesed Hashem? They all should have died. That's the chesed Hashem. They all should have died because they were lacking the basics, the basic dimension of human life. They weren't people anymore. Completely ignorant of God, completely ignorant of the ways that human beings are to relate to each other. They had no redeeming value to their existence. What's that? Their society was corrupt, and individuals, no redeeming value. They all should have died. That's the chesed Hashem. But the b'chorim, well, only the firstborn, and not the rest of society. Value. The blackouts. Yeah, well, that is the, I mean, it happened in Koreatown also, Koran Heights also, in 91, Koreatown 92, but what, in Los Angeles. What it means, that's not, I wouldn't say it's at this level of corruption. All that is taking the Mora Shel Malchus out of the equation. So people then revert to a very naturalistic lifestyle. All right? That's right. Yeah, look, that's you don't need a whole editorial. You don't need two books. That's heavy mispah with Shlomo Shel Malchus. Shemalei Mora'o Ish Esreel Chayim Lo. We should pray for the peace and the wealth of the government. Because if not for government, each man would swallow the other alive. It's, by the way, Ish Esreel, he swallowed his friend alive. Forget his enemy. He swallowed his friend alive. Alive, not even dead. Alive. If but for the fear of government, meaning once you take fear of retribution out of the equation, no criminal justice system, that's what's going to happen. So yeah, that's what happened. You had a society in which, with the blackouts or the LA riots or Crown Heights, there are no authorities, there's no din, there's no dying. So people revert to a pure animalistic, passionate behavior. And can't be controlled. What it tells you, by the way, is that behavior is always under the surface. Always under the surface. Right? Man is one step away from being a beast. Doesn't sound nice, but it's true.
Question?
An example? Our perspective? No, that's different. Holocaust. Holocaust, you see that sophisticated, civilized people are just one small step away from being complete beasts. One small step. And it's a very, very thin line. You know, we like to think it could never happen to us. It's not so. A lot of crimes of passion are committed. And you say, well, how did this guy, he never lift a finger, and here he shot everybody, or he shot 20 people. A modest, placid, unassuming postal worker, all of a sudden, he kills 25 people. How could that happen? All right? So you see, mankind is just a small step away from having the Yetzer Hara completely overcome him and the Nefesh HaBahami taken over. Exactly. Nefesh HaBahami, the animalistic part of his nature. It's just, it's very close.
Okay. That's a lot to read into just some darkness. And for people who are so
that's what you're asking.
That's what I'm saying. For people who are so low, how are they supposed to understand its meaning?
That's correct. It's a good point. But in fact, there was a method of reflection. There was a method of reflection. Because at the very least, it should cause them to sit up and take notice, what is happening to our world? All right, what is that? There must be something that is awry here. And that's very difficult for people to do. So you see, it didn't work. You had to have Makos Bacharis too. Didn't work. That's part of tonight's topic as well. Because that afflicts us also. What's that? That afflicts us also. You know, how many times did Jews say, well, this can't happen. God would never abandon us. You know, God's not going to let the enemies capture the Aron HaKodesh, or destroy the base of Mikdash, or exile us, or let them kill us wantonly, etc., etc. Because we talk it into ourselves, like the Pasuk says. I'm afraid even to say it here, because then you won't come to the Jew tonight. But the Pasuk says this: Canaan said, the Jews went to battle against the Plishtim, and they were killed. 60,000 were killed in one day. And this Canaan said, why were we smitten? What happened? So the role of this Canaan is to give musa to people, right? Do tshuva. No. This came and said, well, we didn't do anything wrong. We're tzaddikim. So it must be. We didn't take the Aron HaKodesh with us into battle. It's completely topsy-turvy world. We live with that also. Sometimes, you know, the signs right in front of us, we choose not to see it. And the Egyptians as well. So they didn't have the background. I know, a clock like this, you know, you don't need much of a background to begin contemplating why these things are happening. I mean, in one moment, you're in a society which is the world's leading and wealthiest empire, dominant empire, and within 9 months, your whole world is changed, all right? You open the tap, blood comes out. You open the oven, frogs come out.
What happened to the Egyptian society after the Jews left? Were they still
They rebuilt, it collapsed because the entire infrastructure was gone. But Chazal would dispute what happened to Paro. Did it go back? Did it fall short? Whatever it was, it didn't really have a lasting effect. Because pagans are pagans, and however it is, you start developing these naturalistic explanations for everything that happened. Bad politician, bad general, you know, etc. That's what it is. In fact, in the movie, Yul Brynner says that. Remember, he says the God of Israel is a bad general because he took them south. Before the Suez Canal, Egypt and Sinai were connected by land. So, the point is not to go watch the movie. The point is, the line reflects the philosophy. The God of Israel is just a general, alright? He's general, I'm a general. And therefore, his tactics are good or bad, depending on the situation. So whatever it was, until now, he had good tactics. Every general stumbles, so now he stumbled. So you're correct in that when you have an entire worldview that seems so real and substantive, and gives you your position in life, and your wealth, your superiority, difficult to abandon. And even if questions are raised, very strong questions, that you're wrong, how could this be, it's not correct, makes no difference. Very hard to shatter it. Works both ways, by the way. Oh, so won't be here for a couple of weeks, but you see, the Jews cross the Yam Suf next week, so what happens? 3 days later, complaining again. And at the end of Bashalach, what do they say? Where's God? Hayesh Hashem Mikrabenu Imayim. And after Maimon HaSinai, what happens? 6 weeks later, they build it. 40 days later, 6 weeks, they build an Egel HaZav. Alright? This is momentous of one, because they're also rooted in a certain primitive approach. And cataclysmic events don't have that deep an impact on people as we think they do. The common assumption is not like that, but it's a false assumption. Cataclysmic events rarely change people's belief patterns. They confirm them. All right. I mentioned several times, I'll say it again. There's a book that was written 20 years ago by a Reformed rabbi called Reeve Robert Brenner. Not many Jews named Reeve, by the way. The point was he studied, I'm sorry, I think it's his book, he studied the beliefs of the Holocaust survivors. And based on his surveys, he said 85% remained with whatever belief system they had. If they were firm, they remained firm. If they were not religious, they remained not religious. Of the 15% who changed, 11% went from being religious to not religious, and 4%, interestingly, went from being not religious to being religious as a result of their experiences. All right? So you're talking a very small percentage of people whose belief system was changed as a result of the Holocaust. And we think, how could that be? How could that be? You see, it's not so. It be. That is the way it is. Cataclysmic events, miracles, disasters do not really change people. In the short term, they do. In the long term, not. All right? You know, you take out terrorism in 9/11, people said, oh, the next few months, everybody's nice to each other, people are, you know, sensitive. Ah, come on, it's finished already. You go on the subway, it's the same thing it ever was. The exact same thing. It has a fair short-term effect. It's not going to change people's personality, unless one is a philosopher, a Ben Torah, a Bar Seichel. If you're contemplative, then you'll assimilate events. Most people are not on that level. Well, what happens here? The Egyptians dwelled in this twofold darkness. Darkness shalmalo, ignorance of God, and darkness shall Gehenna, ignorance of their obligations as human beings, intellectual darkness and a moral darkness. Where is their light? In the dwellings of Israel. What happens after the Makas Hoshach? What happens? What momentous event in the lives of our people? The first mitzvah. The Or of Klal Yisrael, the light of the Jewish people, is the light by which we recognize God and therefore our obligations to other human beings as well. So immediately after B'nai Yisrael Ha'yor B'mosh Rasam, after the contrast between the darkness of Egypt and the light of Klal Yisrael, so there is no light without Torah. So right away we have to be enveloped in a world of mitzvos. Karban Pesach, Rosh Chodesh, Karban Pesach, Matzah, Chometz, Yom Tov, Isser Malacha, etc. Right away all the mitzvos come. And that is really the introduction to our world. There are two worlds in existence, right? There are two peoples in existence. Not to sound arrogant, but there's Klal Yisrael and there's Goyim. Goyim are the nations of the world. We look at it as a conglomerate. Klal Yisrael is a world, a society, a nation that inherently has light because we have Torah mitzvos. And everyone else doesn't have that light, that reflected light. Like we said before, the Shemitz B'nai Noach that emerged through the Torah and give them their purpose in life. So to the extent that they embrace those, so they share in our light, they benefit from our light. The Nivruchu V'chov, Kol Mishpachos Adama, that through us the nations of the world are blessed as well. So that is so far not the universal understanding, but is certainly a growing one. It's a growing understanding. All right, I could tell you this comes up on occasion. The most prominent reason why the Christian evangelicals today are supporters of Israel and lovers of Jews is because of that pasuk. The Nivruchu V'chol Kol Mishpachos Adama, that through Klal Yisrael they see America's blessed. If America's good to Israel, good to the Jews, so blessings accrue to America. Forget everything else. The missionaries, that's the primary reason that motivates them, and they're sincere in that. They think that they're blessed if they help the Jews. So, granted, they have some distortions in their doctrine too. There's no doubt about that. But yet, that hasag is a tremendous one. I mean, halavai, the world should have had that for 2,000 years, rather than seeing Jews a curse, seeing Jews a blessing. But that's what it means. People look at us and they see a light. And this is the way it's supposed to live. Places tremendous responsibilities upon us, by the way, that we're the role models and we have a lot to live up to. But that's exactly what God had in mind for us. And this pasuk really lays it out. When everyone else is in darkness, when the world is in chaos, when the world is seemingly about to be restored to a primordial state, disasters, catastrophe, human suffering, so we still represent that beacon of light to all nations, that there is a way, there is a God, there is a system, there is free choice, there is accountability, there is human responsibility, there's even human interconnectedness, that there is such things, there are such things. And the Jews represent those doctrines in life. And the better we represent them, the speedier we edge the world towards that day when there'll be universal recognition of the light of Israel. And the Nevi'im always speak about that, of course. Famous pasuk, "Unesaticha la'or la'goyim," that famous phrase, "Be the light unto the nations." That phrase, "light unto the nations," really has its origin here. The Navi said it, "or la'goyim," or "la'or la'goyim," for that notion of or being associated with Kal Yisrael. That comes from here, Hosha. When everyone else is in darkness, so we have light. Now, our light, of course, involves, like Rashi says, it involves reckoning with those Rishon in our midst who are not part of the program, and it also involves enabling the nations of the world to recognize the inherent value in their resources, how their resources could be used for positive ends. That's also part of the reparations process here. That here, all their wealth was used for corruption, for human degradation. So now we have to take their wealth and, you know, elevate it so that it should be used in divine service. In fact, that's where they got the raw materials for the Mishkan from Egypt. Unfortunately, a lot of this wealth wound up in the Egel Azov. Alright, before that, wound up in Egel Azov too. So it's a two-edged sword. But nevertheless, that's our task, to elevate our world, to inspire all mankind, and bring the entire earth to service of God. That mission starts here in a very profound way by demonstrating to the Egyptians the lowliness of their lives. But not only they're on the wrong track, but they're really on no track. They've left the tracks because they've left the realm of humanity. And now they have to be brought back in slowly. Many could not. They had to be eliminated to sea, the Red Sea. Many could not. But for the world at large, the story sends a message. And the fact that we're still here to this day to deliver that message is the ultimate proof of v'niflinu anivamcho, that God and the Jewish people are set aside for the world to acknowledge, to respect, to admire, and ultimately to emulate.
Is that what's happening now?
Not yet. That's why we have to get out right after this year and start doing it. Okay, thank you all for coming. Yeah, just to add that the Makos were the great equalizer in Egyptian society, that if before they suffered from moral darkness and elitism, the Makos ended that, especially Choshech, which afflicted everybody, wealthy and poor, and certainly Makos Bechoros, which was mentioned, killed the Paros firstborn, as well as the firstborn of the lowliest individual in the kingdom.